Thank you very much. I want to firstly thank Rabbi Zaitchik, Jeff Westchester, for inviting me to share thoughts, words I hope that will be beneficial for all of us and beyond this evening, to be a part of what I understand to be about a 27-year legacy now of Jeff of Westchester and its impact, obviously far beyond this community. It is absolutely beautiful and heartening to see those who are here this evening, those who are not. So may their efforts continue and only see much bracha and hatzlacha.
Amen.
So wanted to share just my appreciation. Thank you to the Wallers for hosting this evening and opening your warm and wonderful home. Should be a place of only simcha and joy and good health.
Amen.
I'm here to speak about what is, I think, the most awkward topic one could possibly choose. And that is of death and dying. We will often, firstly, identify death and dying as an uncomfortable subject matter. But I dare say that nowadays, I thought, perhaps in 2017, it has become quite awkward. Very uncomfortable, socially challenging, strange, unsure of how to handle death or those kinds of conversations. And I think that delving into why that may be very well help us in understanding the beauty, the meaning that death has to offer through the Torah perspective. And trying to understand why it is that in Western civilization it has become as awkward as it has. I know of at least one person who stopped attending funerals. He stopped attending funerals. Why? Because whenever he would attend a funeral for quite some years, he would laugh. He would laugh. Inexplicably. He would had a nervous laugh. No, perhaps we remember as school children having a nervous laugh about something, whether to some degree was uncontrollable, but we needed to remove ourselves from the situation or have a teacher suggest that we remove ourselves from said situation, at least for a time. And so he stopped attending funerals. Newsweek, in an article that was cited, mentions how death has disappeared from our Western civilization and culture. And if you think about it, not more than a couple hundred years ago, much of the literature, historic recordings and accounts of the life and times of well-known figures also included what surrounded their death, what that might have looked like, and its impact. Whereas now, and we'll get into this just a little bit more to kind of spell out and compound the issue before grappling with it, is how our society does deal with death. Many will host a celebration of life in the hopes that if we are to redirect feelings that are difficult, that are sad. I don't want to use the word depressed. Depression can accompany sadness, but does not necessarily accompany it. But if we suppress it and redirect those feelings of mourning, of sadness over the loss of a loved one, for a celebration of just how wonderful their life was, of some of the lighter moments that were shared or that we remember about them, then perhaps we'll get through it better. That's not really the case. That's not really the case. And I would add to that, well, I don't want to, it's beyond the scope of our conversation this evening, is a sense that as human beings, our feelings and our natural drives are toward immortality. Death is not for me. Death happens to other people. Death happens to old people. One of my sons has a Rebbe, a rabbi who teaches him. He is, thank God, 78 years old, still going quite strong. I just met him this past weekend, and he also, I will share with you, has a witty and sharp sense of humor. He shared with these ninth grade boys that periodically, maybe once or twice a week, when he's done teaching, he goes to visit the old people in the nursing home, which to my 14-year-old and his friends is hilarious, right? But it's interesting how we, I think at any age, right, I don't look at, but I did just turn 40, always look to those who are older than us as old. They're old. Right? I'm not old, but they're old. So what has happened, I think, is that there's this element of discomfort. Someone has lost a loved one. I don't know what to say to make it better for them. I don't know how to approach them, never mind in an empathic way, but even in a way that just, you know, I'm bearing myself to a there in a vulnerable position, and much of what society around us wants to promote is happiness. How happy are you? What are you taking that helps make you happy, right? There is no, I assure you, and I know very little about marketing, but there is no successful marketing surrounding sadness. If you'd like to be sad and really have a meaningful Tisha B'Av experience, you should buy this product. The phones will not be ringing off the hook with such a tack. It just won't happen, right? We're all about the happiness. We're all about how happy are you? How are you doing, right? How is work? Are you happy? How are you doing in school? Are you happy? Happiness is very important. A sense of well-being and a sense of joy and meaning in life is very important. But I think in order to understand from where this awkwardness and difficulty and discomfort comes, we have to understand what it is and why it is that the Torah and Judaism views this very differently. And in order to understand, and some of my quotes are loosely quoted from Rabbi Zon, the director of the National Association of Chevra Kadisha, and arguably the foremost authority on perhaps end of life, more tahara, and the process that follows thereafter, and burial both here in Israel and internationally. And, you know, I mentioned to him, he doesn't want to necessarily need any credit. There was a rabbi, actually, who had said years back that he preferred that his students rather use his material in their name than use their own material in his name. So, in other words, better to say something that was my thought but not attributed to me than to say something that was not my thought and say that it was. So, but again, Rabbi Zona shares is a wealth of valuable insight and experience. And he says that in order to understand the value of death, one must delve into and understand the value of life. Then that will help us understand what that narrow bridge is and what a little bit of that process of crossing, if you will, the narrow bridge is all about. What is it that's still there when a person passes on? What is it that we miss? We know that their legacy remains, often spoken about, but I think if you come with me on about a half a minute or a minute long exercise, we may be able to put this into very real terms for ourselves. I'd like for each of us to think about for a moment someone to whom we very much looked up, someone whom we admired back from our childhood or adolescence, not someone from a distance who was an icon, and therefore we idolize them as being the perfect human being. someone who touched our lives and impacted upon us in a very profoundly positive way. I hope that more than one person comes to mind, because we take that with us through our lives, in some of the ways that we conduct ourselves, in some of the ways that we speak with others, in some of the ways that we emote with others around us. If that person who we are thinking about is no longer with us, think about what it is that they've left with us. There are those who played ball with me when I was younger, and most anybody could throw a ball to me. Most anyone could cheer me on if I was at a piano recital. But what went into it? What was it that they brought and shared with me? It was a wealth and the cumulative experiences that defined them that they gave over to me. I want to repeat that once more. It was the cumulative and sum total of their experiences that they invested and gave over to me. That doesn't die. That is, as Rabbi Zohn mentions, the closest we can come to understanding what a neshama, what a soul, truly is. What is a soul? Which part of us is a soul? It's very hard to understand, right? Soul is the kishkas of a person, I think in old Latin, right? So, but the soul is the essence. The soul is that entire package, if you will, of what that person was and is to us. That doesn't die. I want to share with you a very stark contrast that I personally experienced, and I learned quite a bit from it. You know, nowadays, if you think about, on the other hand, I want you to think of an example, and I don't find it necessary to share one with you, but an example of an icon, perhaps from pop culture or otherwise, of a person toward the end of their lives whose basically their circumstances surrounding the end of their life became very closed off from the public eye. Perhaps they'd lived under the scrutiny and paparazzi of the public for many years, and then they passed away. It wasn't anyone's business. Perhaps the family wanted to shield them from prying eyes. It was 22 years ago that I was studying in Israel, and I had my first experiences with a Hasidic tish. Young fellows, a Friday evening after the Shabbos meal, go to, and it almost cheapens it, but the word on the street about the different tishes and which Hasidic groups have the largest crowds and which have, you know, the greatest singing and which one is, we went to one that was particularly, it was very interesting, it was very particularly mournful. And their style of music for hundreds of years now has been very mournful from Slunim. To add to that effect, and that's not the anecdote I was going to share with you, it's just still very striking. To add to that effect, I see them on the wall here, but the Shabbos clocks, the timers, would turn off the lights in the middle of their tish. So first of all, there are a couple hundred people singing the most mournful tunes together. And then the lights go out, and they continue to sing in the pitch dark. And if you're fortunate enough to know your way back out, if you wanted to leave, it's a very powerful experience, but not the one I wanted to share with you. So I digress. The one I wanted to share with you was of the Toldos Aaron Hasidic group down in Mea Shearim, a section of Jerusalem. I would not be able to find any of these places in broad daylight. We went with someone who knew how you turn, how you go in, and what. The Toldos Aaron Hasidic group is now, since the passing of their leader, speaking of the lights, but it's only about 2 minutes off cue, but the The group had, I'm going to say, close to between 500 and 1,000 Hasidim in a very, very large hall on bleachers, singing together, rocking back and forth, a very, very powerful experience. At a certain point, the singing stopped, and from a very small door in the front and off to a little bit of the side of the room, the door opened, and a younger chassid was pushing a wheelchair out into the room to the dais, the head table. In that wheelchair was a man who, excuse me for saying it, but he looked like he was 200 years old, very, very clearly aged person, didn't seem to be very much aware of his surroundings. It was placed at a very prominent position at the dais. After which, the singing resumed and it continued on. And I asked someone, who is that? He said, that is the Toldos Aharon Rebbe. That was the leader of the Toldos Aharon Hasidic group. I said, is he not well? Is he, and again, when I was 18 years old, a very impressionable person, they said, he probably doesn't know where he is. He unfortunately has advanced stage Alzheimer's. He is physically very weak. He knows very little of what goes on around him. So at the time, and perhaps so that I could learn from it, my youthful impetuosity, or more accurately, chutzpah, I kind of asked to one degree or another, not the rabbi himself, but the person I was speaking with, well, why, what's the point? Why do you bring him out? Like, what? He doesn't know what's going on around him. You have hundreds of people in this whole inspiring thing, and you propped somebody up in the front, supposedly so that maybe he'll enjoy it or know what's going on. And it was explained to me, and this made a very poignant impact upon me, that there are thousands of people, many of whom were there and many were not, whose lives were touched so powerfully by this human being in one way or another. Whether they'd studied Torah with him, whether they'd listened to his lectures, whether he listened to them and shared with them through their experiences. I didn't look this up, but clearly, no, he had come from Europe and quite possibly had gone through the Holocaust. The very least had transplanted his group from Europe and had been through quite a bit. And therefore, the body that housed such a soul, such a neshama, meant so much to this group that if he is alive and able to be brought into the room, what that did for this group is invaluable. It's invaluable. It's intangible. Again, the contrast is stark. Where in Western civilization would a figure, no matter how powerful or impactful, be wheeled out, unaware of their surroundings, to be paraded in some display of pageantry, right? And the examples go on and on. We don't see from them. We don't know from them. They're not well. We don't talk about it. Whatever it is, leave it, right? It's a different viewpoint of what that value of life is. And therefore, a very different viewpoint about what the value of death is. See, the part that I spoke about in terms of a legacy of what touched our lives, the confidence that another human being instilled within us. And I mentioned this contrast before. It's fascinating, and it's, again, related to our talk tonight, but it's not the direct topic. But, you know, we always, and truth is, the Torah uses parables and metaphors of animals and their abilities, right? And human beings strive to be as strong as a lion and as fast as a leopard and as beautiful has the most beautiful, ornate, pretty and elegant animals of the world. And we're not. We're not. You go up to the mountains and watch the deer as they prance and run through fields and hop over things. We will not run in that way. Never will a human being be as attractive as the most beautiful and graceful animals out there. These are physical attributes. And there's one thing that an animal can't do, that a human being can do. And that is give encouragement. That is empathize. We read about, you know, the rare animal that will stay with its mate while it is dying and not leave its side. But the human being is able to go to another human being and build them up and mimic Hashem's ways in taking a person, no matter where they are, whether they are at a low and difficult spot, or they are having just an average day and going about their business, and elevating them, and sharing a kind word, sharing a Torah thought that's empowering and encouraging. And therefore, that neshama, that soul, continues to live on. Those individuals that we thought about just a few moments ago are still within us. That is what happens when a person dies. Two parts. One, the body that housed a neshama is given the utmost of respect and dignity. It's not simply the shell that housed something far more important, but now we're done with the body. As evidenced by the head of the Toldos Aharon Chassidim, whose life and neshama was very much with those Chassidim in that room, even though physically he may not have been. And after he passed away, as I saw 2 years later in 1996, his lessons, his experiences, everything that he put into his followers and his family is still with them. That's an neshama that we are caring for. That is an neshama that therefore we, immediately after death, do not leave the bedside of one who has departed. And a shomer, a watch person, stays with the body of the deceased and says psalms ongoing on behalf of that soul, on behalf of that neshama. Not symbolizing, but showing that this is a neshama that continues on in a very real way, even though it is intangible to us. When we think about it, I have some brochures and some materials for your edification at the end. I learned in teacher training school, actually, not to give out materials till the end of the presentation. Otherwise, everyone will be distracted reading the materials and they won't listen to you. So I'm not going to tell you where the materials are. But, you know, some of those materials and brief descriptions of what the Hebrew Burial Society, the Chevra Kadisha, does, including but not limited to the fact that someone stays with the body of the deceased until the funeral. It's not left alone. It's not left alone. Including that we do not perform mitzvos in front of the deceased. We don't perform mitzvos. There are those who wear their tzitzis out. I don't. It's another. But there are those who do. It is perhaps it's a fringe benefit of living in a Jewish neighborhood. Ha ha. Poor sense of humor. my subject matter does not lend to very much humor, so at least I can throw a pun in that's a little bit out of. So, we don't wear our tzitzis out in a cemetery. We don't make a bracha or pray or daven in the presence of the deceased or in a cemetery. Why not? We say psalms on their behalf. But we're doing something that person can no longer do. That soul can no longer perform mitzvos. In this world, we have the opportunity to perform mitzvos, and at the end of that, that's it. That's the end of the opportunity. And the only furtherance of that soul as what others are doing on behalf of it. And therefore wouldn't be appropriate. The concept is called lo'eg l'rush, which means basically you're almost poking fun at the one who is indigent. Right? You're showing, I have a mitzvah I can perform here, even though you can't. So we don't do that. There's a sensitivity to that soul. The Chevra Kadisha is told the Hebrew name of the individual. Posts that name, as I've seen and heard in other communities, that a Chevra will post that name as they are going through the entire purification process so that it is prominent and everyone knows this is the person whom we are tending to. This is the neshama that we are caring for. Rabbi Zohn tells a fascinating story, and we could be here for days with the stories that come through our office, literally on a daily basis. Just very, very interesting questions that come through, and dilemmas and anecdotes that are very inspiring. And anyway, long story short, as Rabbi Zohn tells the story very effectively, as it happened with him. But basically, there was a family member who wanted for their loved one to be buried in his fanciest suit. His fanciest suit. Right? He was always, as I think she said, the nattiest dresser. I hadn't heard that term in very many years. And therefore, you know, we understand that the burial society uses plain white shrouds, but then over the shrouds, we're going to gave the funeral director his finest suit. And so Rabbi Zohn shared very sensitively, very delicately with this family member that her loved one dressed obviously to a T, but most appropriate for every occasion. And when he went to bed, what did he wear? He wore his silk pajamas. And when he went to such and such an occasion, what did he wear? And he wore the most appropriate outfit. And so Rabbi Zohn, as I think only he can do, shared, your loved one is now being accompanied, a levaya, an accompaniment to a burial, devoid of any and all materialism, to show their neshama to its creator. And the most appropriate mode of dress is the most simple one, is the most, right, bare and stripped of any of the trappings of physicality, the one that just presents the person, so to speak, in a very natural way. This burial society, this Chevra Kadisha, and just the amazing work that they do, I was privileged to be involved with it in Columbus, Ohio, and here much more in an ancillary, if not administrative capacity, but the work is very special. It is a group of preferably no fewer than four people tending to the washing and very careful care of the preparation of the body of a deceased. And without very much detail, the difference between four people caring for, lifting, cleaning, covering those parts that should remain covered except while being cleansed, and doing so together with that focus, as contrasted with an individual funeral director handling a body by his or herself, is obviously a very different situation. This Chevra Kadisha, the burial society, washes their hands in purification in advance of their process. And finally, as they go out to perform what is literally, and we refer to this as chesed shel emes, it is a kindness and a graciousness of truth. Here they are giving of their time, giving of their efforts and energies, sometimes cleaning what is an unpleasant situation, to a body, to a person that cannot and will not give anything in return. This is pure kindness and chesed. There is nothing to be expected. There's no thank you card that will come. There's no When I have an event, I'm sure you'll bring by a candy dish or some flowers or such. There's no anticipation for anything in return. And to cap it all off, the last thing that the Chevra Kadisha does when they've completed their procedure and properly wrapped and cleaned and prepared and with the utmost of respect, what's the last thing they do before taking leave of the company of the deceased? They ask for forgiveness. They ask for forgiveness. The head of the group says, so-and-so, son or daughter of so-and-so, we have tried our utmost to execute our job in a respectful way that you deserved. If we had fallen short in omitting or committing, God forbid, anything that was untoward or inappropriate, we beg for you to forgive us. Imagine. Such a selfless act that's being done. Most often, 9, 10 o'clock at night, or early in the morning, as close to the burial as possible. A very devoted and special, almost secret society of people who do this for no other reason than the magnitude and how special and meaningful that is, to then ask and beg that this person forgive them if there's anything that they could have done differently. Those who are closest relatives to a deceased do not perform positive commandments. They don't do mitzvos. Right? They don't daven. They don't make a bracha on a food. All of their positive mitzvos are suspended. For the sole reason, excuse the pun, for the sole reason, that now is the time when they are to be focusing on the care and the proceedings of what that deceased and departed needs. Whether they are directly involved, whether they are traveling to a burial, to a funeral, they are not to be performing mitzvahs. The Torah says this soul needs them at that point. Needs for them to be focused on that neshama. Part of that, and again, not the scope of our discussion tonight, but I will throw in the hint because I think it has value. Part of that is the very important, healthy, cathartic experience of the pain and sadness of the loss of a loved one. That is a very healthy thing. Now, healthy and painful and sad usually don't come in the same sentence. But God, Hashem, in His infinite wisdom, understands that we as human beings will go through, should know from it that relatives should live and be well. The human being needs to go through suspending any and all positive mitzvah activity. Suspend it. Just sit in that moment. Sit in a shiva where the work and other related activities are suspended. And focus. And have moments of pain and crying and sadness, moments of sharing and reflecting meaningful memories and experiences with others. And moments of just disbelief. And the human being responds and reacts in a very healthy way to that. You know, eulogies, and I think shiva houses closely related, brings us back to, you know, where we started from. It's the awkwardness. Very awkward topic. Don't know how to handle it. It's just strange, right? And much in the way that, unfortunately, a hesped or eulogy can turn into a comedy hour. Remember when they said this funny line? Do you remember when they did this? Right? So-and-so is now up in heaven, you know, with their... she was so opinionated, I'm sure she has a few words to share with God about how things are going on, right? Again, a eulogy as something that is meaningful, is addressing a neshama, a soul that impacted upon people, with rare exception, we hope, almost always in a very positive way. as sad as it was, I suppose it's sadly humorous that in officiating at a funeral, as I've done quite a number of times, but years back, there's a family and a deceased, the deceased I'd never met before, and I was asked to officiate. And so I said, I don't want to share anything that, you know, gives the impression that I knew the person. Obviously, if there are characteristics that you'd like for me to underscore or relate to a Torah concept that would be meaningful for people, I'd like to do that. And I shared a few attributes that I felt perhaps might be helpful for people to hear about. And as I shared each of these few attributes, the relative said, no, not that one. And perhaps we want to make mention of, a generosity. Or, no, not that. You know, when I got to a third one, you know, a kindness or the way they related to. At which point, one of the relatives said, Rabbi? I said, yes. He says, Uncle so-and-so had a personality that very effectively alienated a lot of people. Was sadly, but very tellingly so, was saying to me, don't try to make this person out to something or someone that he wasn't. And so I said, I'll share something that's a meaningful Torah concept of, and something that will, I hope, be helpful. This is where, again, you know, the framework of what we're trying to do in such occasions and surrounding, you know, a funeral, a death, a shiva house. And my wife and I were sitting in a restaurant, I believe it was already at least 11, 12 years ago or so. I'll be a little bit intentionally vague because it was in the New York area. But and we overheard a group of women a few tables over having somewhat of an animated conversation about the recent shiva houses that they'd attended. Oh, that one was great. You should have seen that. This one was there, and they had this and that, and they also served this, and it was great. Until the point at which one of the women said, you know, except that one shiva house at such and such, that was just terrible. I mean, it was morbid, you know, and they're sitting there, and they didn't know what to say, they don't know what to talk about. I mean, phew, that was something else. At which point, one of the women's teenage daughter, who was sitting there with the group, said, isn't that what a shiva house is supposed to be? Right? At which point, the conversation shifted to some other topic. So, again, it's awkward. It's not comfortable. And the reason I think why it's so awkward and so uncomfortable is because we're not familiar with it. It's just not something we want to be familiar with. We don't want it to be something that we're involved in, right? Because there's a natural aversion to death and dying. It's not relevant to me. It's not happening to me. It's not happening to my relative. I'm going to talk about planning things. We don't talk about such things, right? Poo, 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 and this, that, right? Till 120 and everything is all gesund and all kinds of other Yiddish things, right? But we don't talk about it. And I'm here this evening to share with you that I think we should. I think we should. And there are a number of reasons for that. One of the reasons, and I'll share the materials with you in a few moments, one of the reasons is that many people, unfortunately, at an end-of-life situation, with a lack of preparedness, or lack of direction given over to loved ones, could have decisions made for them by people who don't know them at all. Life, decisions of life and death, right? Decisions of just, you know, a couple of examples, whether it is nutrition and hydration, whether it is a do not resuscitate. In many instances, these things should be signed, particularly if it will be more painful or damaging to a person to try to take heroic measures. And such in every situation is nuanced and requires its own, you know, analysis. But if a starting point is, this is something that's important to me, this is something that I want for my relatives, for my children, for my close friends to know, then there is direction, and at least, obviously, all is in Hashem and God's hands. But under those circumstances, to be prepared, there's no comparison. There's no comparison. One of the items, therefore, just practically speaking, it is called a halachic living will. It is state-specific. I have copies of the New York State one with me that will be available to you. That identifies, A, one's wishes, and B, a person or persons who have been designated to assist in carrying out those wishes. Because if that is not designated, it will not be carried out necessarily by a loved one or a guide, a mentor, or you know, with the assistance of a rabbi and the type of authority and sense of what we are trying to do in very, very delicate moments of one's life. That is number one. Number two, and more important, not as important, whatever the case may be, is in terms of the preparedness spiritually. This is, if everything I've said up until this point is not popular, not comfortable, and no one wants to hear about, for some reason, what I'm about to say is off the charts completely, not spoken of. Thank you for having me. Have a great evening. No. And that is actually of one's spiritual wishes. What is the ethical will that a person wants to give over to their loved ones? What was most important to that person? What wasn't as important to that person? You know how many people pass away without sharing that with their loved ones? How sad. How sad. Right? There's a person, this was shared with me not that long ago, it's a person who is a very illustrious Torah scholar. Well written, well studied to this day. Had a daughter who chose to move away from religiosity and observance. She was very successful in her own ways, very secular. Interestingly, though, she married her children off to Jewish spouses. Male children had a bris. After the passing of her father, she shared the following. She said, my father was an illustrious Torah scholar, world-renowned, somewhat of a household name. He wrote a letter to me back, I believe, when I was in high school. In that letter, basically said what he wanted for me. And it wasn't in terms of my observance, and he already recognized within me that I was taking a different path than he had chosen for himself. He wanted for me to be proud to be a Jew. He wanted for me to carry that and transmit that to my children. He wanted me to be successful, and he knew that I could and would be. And his love, his overarching and unconditional love, is between every one of those lines in that letter. She said, not a day has passed in my life since receiving that letter that I have not opened it and read it through. It seems so simple. It's not me. If my name were Rabbi Doctor this, that, or the other thing, and I was eloquent and well-written and knew how to express these thoughts and what I'm trying to put together, then I would. What about how much love a parent has for their child? What about how proud they are of them? What about a friend or relative saying, family always meant more to me, no matter how busy I was. I value this. This is something that's important to me. You know, my grandfather, of blessed memory, who passed away just over a year ago, was a very quiet person. He was a GI in World War II. On a good day, he was 5 feet tall. I think in later years, he'd even lost a few inches. Very soft-spoken. Very quiet, very soft-spoken. But I pulled it out of him. I think it was also around that age of chutzpah. And I asked him point blank. German descent, I called him Opa. I said, Opa, what's the most important thing to you in life? What a fascinating question to ask. I ask that question very often. Hi, my name is Chaim Yosef Ackerman. What's most important to you? And he didn't hesitate. He said family, like that. Like, what color is your tie? Huh? Family. He'd been through a lot. Transplanted his family, transplanted his congregation from Germany, fought in the war, was an accomplished machinist, president of his shul for very many years, involved in very many things. That was the first thing came right out of his mouth. Came right out of his mouth. Right? He's a person, a personality who wasn't going to sit down and put pen to paper. Maybe we can, maybe we can't. You know, we record it, video, we write down some notes. Can make a very, very strong impact upon those who we think won't really bother with it. They very well might. They very well might. Before I conclude and wrap up and share the materials that are here for you, I want to touch upon really dovetailing the rest of our talk this evening, and I certainly want to open the floor for your. As one professor of mine in university used to say, questions, comments, or rude remarks. So, I didn't share any rude remarks, don't worry. And that is a very important topic that I would encourage you to read up about, study more about. I'm not going to be able to address it with the time and breadth of knowledge that it deserves, and that is of burial versus cremation. This is something that up until probably 30, 40 years ago was not even a discussion. I believe it was in the 1700s that a well-known scholar, not of Jewish background, wrote, Jews bury their dead. Third. Point of fact, Jews bury their dead. As I stand here in 2017, the numbers are growing across the country. Whatever the reasons may be, whether they are financially related, whether they are driven or motivated by other reasons. And I'll share with you that the element and what I described about what the Chevra Kadisha does, what I described about what the legacy of a person is about, speaks to the reason and reasons why we bury our loved ones. We bury a treasure and have a place to go to pray on their behalf, but to ask them to intercede on ours. You know, ninth grade is the 1 year that Rabbi Kassir of blessed memory took a sabbatical. And I share this with you for the following reason. Rabbi Kassir was a ninth grade Rebbe in the Yeshiva Chafetz Chaim in Forest Hills. It was the 1 year of high school that I spent in Queens. As the 1 year during his sabbatical, I believe, I'm about to be corrected if I'm wrong, that Rabbi Zaitchik taught in the ninth grade in the Chafetz Chaim in Queens. Am I correct?
Okay.
So my recollection was Rabbi Kassir was on sabbatical, Rabbi Zaitchik had taken over. I, whatever the case may be, Hashem decided I was in the other ninth grade class and had Rabbi Singer. But we were under the same roof. So in any case, why did I bring that up? My grandmother, of blessed memory, lived not too far. My parents were in Baltimore, Maryland. I was there as a 14-year-old in Queens. And my grandmother lived in Jackson Heights, maybe a 15-minute drive away. There are certain things that a grandmother can do that others cannot do. There's just certain things they can. And therefore, when my grandmother found out that I had run out of undershirts, she went to Alexander's, purchased the undershirts, went into the office to speak to the secretary, who was a long-standing friend of hers, explained that she was there with new undershirts for her grandson. It's something a grandmother can do. That's just what she can do. When she passed away suddenly the next year, at the age of 66, it was very difficult for me. And so more than once or twice, I went to her grave. And I davened for her. And I asked her to help me. You know, and a lot of what she had given over to me, right? You know, you describe things and try to put them into physical terms, but it wasn't. It was so much more than that. It was so much of the unspoken, it's like I say, what a grandmother could do for a grandchild. It's just what it was. Many have regretted the cremation of a loved one. It's very difficult to have an element of closure. And there's a very, very sad statistic that across this country there are thousands, at this point probably hundreds of thousands, of unclaimed urns of the remains of loved ones. Just didn't bother. Something didn't remember, didn't bother, didn't. The process, as painful and as difficult as it is for a loved one to stand by or to participate in placing dirt onto the casket of their loved one as they are reunited with the dust from whence they had come. I'm not saying for a moment that it is easy. I'm not saying for a moment that it is enjoyable. It's very painful. It could be very, very difficult. And about a year and a half ago, 2.5 years ago, excuse me, it was in Israel burying a chayal, a soldier of the IDF, who was 22 years old, I believe. It's very, very difficult. You pour bags and bags of sand to a grave. But the catharsis that is experienced, because you've given yourself that opportunity to pain and to grieve and be sad, because you are entitled to and you should, is something that then carries us through. And knowing that, and knowing that the funeral service and everything surrounding it is not for those in attendance. There are not flowers adorning the entire funeral home so that you and I can walk in and say, what a beautiful funeral. What a nice drink I had. And I hadn't seen George for years. I mean, there he is. Put on a few pounds, but it's not what it's for. It's for a soul that touched and impacted upon others' lives and therefore is now continuing on with their legacy in an intangible way. And we are here to give the utmost respect to that. So I want to review and I want to share the materials and, as I say, open the floor to your questions or thoughts. Death is awkward. It's just awkward and strange. You find the rare person, and I hope you have the opportunity, and I hope it's at a simcha, at a joyous occasion, to meet Rabbi Zohn. Rabbi Zohn, I know we're being recorded, and he's probably going to hear this, and all right, so I've done worse things. It's a very personable person, very there with you, very sensitive, right? Part of why I think people are so comfortable with him is because he is so comfortable being around death. Because he understands it. He understands how special and how privileged this kind of work is. And to share and guide people through that process. No one enjoys it. I was thrilled. I had a thank you card in the office. What a fantastic funeral you put on. It's not happening. But the meaning that's given and the ability to empathize and be with other people during those moments. Very, very powerful. Society around us, as I mentioned, has moved away from this. Newsweek said it in 1978. It's all but disappeared from Western civilization. It's not talked about. put it on the side. Celebrate life, maybe. We'll redirect it. We're immune to it. We don't want to know about it. It's scary. It's unfamiliar. We're going to talk about it. But what we then shared is what I posit as in understanding the value of death requires to first understand the value of life. And the value of a neshama, of a soul, as it continues to impact in this world. First, as I mentioned in that example of the Toldos Aharon Rebbe, what was he doing? He's still alive. Barely. He's sitting in a wheelchair. He's not speaking to anyone. He doesn't know where he is. But he's there with people. His presence represents everything that he had invested into all of those people. That was invaluable to them. That goes beyond the physicality and the here and now of the human being. That legacy remains. When we understand that, and we shared that exercise of thinking about and identifying someone whom we admired, we looked up to, what was it that we looked up to about them? How have we carried that out in our own lives? And sometimes we hear ourselves saying something or conducting ourselves in a way that we learn from that person. Probably by example. And we saw how they handled the situation or how they spoke or comported themselves. That's what we miss most about them. That's what the human being, as I mentioned, can do for the fellow human being. The building them up. That continues beyond one's life. And that's why it is so important that we be there for a neshama when that neshama is taking and crossing that narrow bridge. What that's about and what that means, I don't know. I don't know, and maybe you can pick Rabbi Zaitchik's brain on that at some later date. What that means in a spiritual realm. But for us, that's what that means. That means that now I don't have you here anymore, but I have what you represented with me. I'm never going to let that go. And I know that these moments surrounding that person's passing are so delicate and sensitive. We described what the Chevra Kadisha does. We described what close relatives don't do in their presence or anywhere for that matter. Because now is the time for me to think about that soul. Now is the time for me to bolster it and empower it in whatever spiritual ways I possibly can. And continue to learn from their example. I therefore encouraged, as I continue to encourage all of you to prepare. Prepare in two ways. One, the very pragmatic ways of medical directives, halachic living wills, the RCA, as well as the Agudath Israel, have versions of this. I will describe to you in a moment what the MS card represents and the living will, and there is a literature accompanying it that spells out in bullet points, just straightforward terms of how to do that. And what I said was even more uncomfortable and unspoken. And that is about a spiritual or ethical will. Think about it. Whether you carry it out in one way or another, or you know, Dr. David Pelkowitz from Yeshiva University speaks about that every family has a bumper sticker. Every family has a bumper sticker. What do you mean a bumper sticker? I don't have a bumper sticker. I don't know. As I do, actually. A bumper magnet. What does that mean? Every family has an idea or concept that's most important to them. It's what they live for. You see it on the walls of their home. You see it on the coffee table. What's the subject matter? What are the pictures that adorn the mantles and bookcases and walls around the house? That's the family's bumper sticker. If you don't share that ethical bumper sticker, as that illustrious, world-renowned Torah scholar did to his daughter, and wrote a letter that she read every day of her life. And she didn't, you know, it's not one of these storybook. It turned out that she started observing all the mitzvahs and what she didn't. You know what? She didn't. But she made decisions in her life to be a very proud Jew in very, very meaningful ways because of what her father gave over to her in a letter. That's very powerful. Something here for you as well that I actually don't have something here for you. Not going to lie to you. There's other literature and information that's available on the subject of traditional burial versus cremation, some of the important statistics, both as I mentioned from the cathartic and practical standpoints, as well as other environmental facts and data that is a very interesting research that's available from National Association of Chevra Kadisha. Rabbi Zaitchik mentioned, and thank God we have 428 outreach centers, congregations. We're actually international now. We're up in Canada. We're on the island of St. Martin. We are in Slovakia and Ashkelon, Israel. This Shabbos, Jacob, our forefather Yaakov, gave those last words, which I will use to my advantage because they were, aside from saying where he wanted to be buried, he also had given over an ethical will to each of his children, right? We use that opportunity, and this is really what it's about. It's strictly an awareness campaign. It is to provoke conversation. These conversations that start out as difficult, but these conversations that I think are very, very meaningful. And when that's given over from us, and we're ready to talk about certain things. I remember my parents sent myself and my brothers copies of the deeds to their plots in a cemetery in Israel. It's a while back. And my brothers and I, you know, reached out to each other, like, that's really weird. That is just really strange. Like, mom and dad sent us that they want to be buried there. I thought it was really bizarre. Started to make a lot more sense. You know, they should live and be well. And these are the things, as I said, and I share my humble bracha, you know, my heartfelt wishes. You know, gathering comes together for the sake of growth, for the sake of Torah. That is what our sages say is a relationship that has permanence. It's founded upon something that has meaning. I think, and it's come across to me as a very sincere and motivated group to learn about and study about topics that are not popular. There are so many other things that we could have talked about, but we've chosen to speak about this, and our association is always available to be of assistance. I only wish the best of health and nachas and meaning in each and every one of your lives, and I want to thank you very much again for having me.
Okay, now, off the record...